This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 12th, and this is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Ethan Genter at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks with our State House reporter, Katie Lannan. We hear from Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light and CAI's Elsa Partan. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands in elemental week for the region. Biggest story of the week took place in the sky overhead, and another big story in the earth under our feet. CAI's Eve Zukoff is here to talk about major natural events. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
The eclipse, obviously a big deal here. Lots of people excited to see it. On Monday, you covered it by spending time at Wacoit Bay in Falmouth. What was this about? Set the scene for us.
Yeah, okay. So I pulled into the National Estuarian Research Reserve about 15 minutes before the eclipse began, around 2:18, and I was one of the last cars to make it in. There were about 300 people all packed in on picnic blankets, beach chairs. We were right by the water, and it was very sweet. It was a lot of mother-daughter duos, mother-son pairs, couples, friends, coworkers, some younger kids, and the state, they were there. They put on this event. They passed out eclipse glasses, but they ran out and asked people to share. A state official who put this on along with seven other events around the state, including one at Nickerson Park in Brewster, said they had no idea it would be this mobbed.
So everybody came out kind of to watch this thing happen in the sky together.
Yeah.
It's one of the really interesting things about the eclipse, I think, is that it's this celestial event, but as human beings, we like gather together to watch this thing happen. And what did you hear from people as you wandered through this crowd of 300 or more people?
Yeah, the communal piece was such an important element for people. But it was a mix of reactions. You know, we saw about 90% of the moon pass in front of the sun, so there wasn't the dramatic darkening that those with a 100% viewing got, but it did get cooler, it got dimmer. So some people were a little disappointed. There was kind of a, is that it? You know, thing that rang out a little bit around 3:31. But others said it made them feel their place in the universe and they felt their place in a community. I talked to Diane Anderson, who watched the eclipse from a big picnic table with a friend. They ended up meeting other people who became friends at the picnic table. And she said that the best part was being with others. She said, this is bringing the whole community together. It's bringing us to this spot, which we've never been to before. And then looking at all these people here, it's wonderful to see we're all in the same place with the same thoughts in mind.
Mm.
Which is like, when do you get that other than a concert or... I don't know. That was a nice piece of it.
I think from the news side, it was such an interesting story because we knew it was coming.
Mm.
It's like a big news event that you know is coming weeks, months in advance.
Yeah.
That almost never happens.
Like, as far as...
And we know what's going to happen. Like if you know an election's coming, it's coming, but you have no idea what's going to happen. But with an eclipse... They know exactly what's going to happen. The only thing that was up in the air was the weather, I guess.
Yes, very true. No, with natural disaster, with anything natural events, it's typically like we find out with
and
everyone that day.
And we respond quickly, yes.
Yeah, but this one, no, it was a whole different feeling covering it.
So what was it like for you being there and watching the 90% totality?
Well, this made me just want to see the next eclipse, you know, not as a reporter, but as a human being, I guess. I got some glimpses up at the sun and moon with my glasses, not enough to really form a strong feeling, but I loved watching people's wonder at it. My favorite parts probably were talking to three-year-olds in the crowd who would put on their pitch black glasses and look every direction but the sun, basically. and talking to the, you know, older mother-daughter duos, the people that were there with a parent who was in their late 80s or 90s. And it's like, this is, you know, maybe one of the last big, big, big things, and we are experiencing it here together. I really loved those conversations.
Mm. And you captured a number of really nice conversations from that event that we put on the radio. It was great to hear people just kind of responding in real time to this event that's happening all around us.
Mm.
is wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move from outer space to the Earth's crust. Now, just after the news roundup last Friday, news broke that an earthquake in New Jersey could be felt all over the region. Lots of people in our region say they felt it I was working here in the studio after the news roundup. I didn't feel it. What did you learn about how locals experienced this as you started to research?
Yeah, lots of people across the Cape Coast and Islands reported their homes shaking or reported having felt it. All over social media, we were seeing comments.
I'm jealous.
I know. We were in this hole. We felt nothing. I got a message from someone who said that their linen cabinet, they were on the South Coast, was shaking in an old historic home. And they said, okay, this is either an earthquake or I have a ghost. But not everyone felt it, which makes sense. A USGS geophysicist, US Geological Survey, they told me that whether one individual noticed shaking beneath their feet has to do with a number of factors, like what type of structure they're in, what kind of ground the structure is on, and how strong the foundation is. Those in a bed on the tallest story of a building were more likely to feel it, for example, than those in a car.
This earthquake was centered in New Jersey. One of the first questions we started asking ourselves about here was, why could we feel it so far away? If all the way in New Jersey, why are we feeling it on Cape Cod and all through New England? You did a little research. What did you find?
Yeah, people could feel it as far away as far south as Virginia and as far north as Maine. And the answer of why has to do with seismic waves. That's the thing you feel shaking during an earthquake. They can travel faster and further through the ground on the East Coast than they can on the West Coast. This geophysicist at USGS, William Barnhart, says that that's because the rock beneath our feet is much more cohesive than it is in a place like California, where you'll feel really big, concentrated earthquakes. He said, use the example of a bell. He said, think of a nice, freshly forged bell that you would ring. If you ring that, it rings for a really long time. Whereas if you have a cracked bell or something like that, it wouldn't ring for as long. What's more, the Cape region is made up of sandy soil. We talk about this all the time, which acts like a trampoline for seismic waves. So we did get stronger shaking here than if we were further west in the Berkshires on hard rock. If you're on hard rock, you wouldn't feel the shaking as strongly as when you're on sandy sediments.
Talk about infrastructure for a second here, because that was one of the questions that came up after this earthquake. Did it affect anything major in the region?
Yeah, I talked to the Cape's Emergency Management Department. They said no major impacts were reported. The Cape Cod Canal bridges were inspected day of, and experts observed no damage or issues on the bridges. The hurricane barriers at Fox Point, they were also inspected. No damage was reserved there. Chip Riley, the Emergency Preparedness Director for Brunswick County, he said that there were no reports of major shaking by the towns, you know, on anything important. I'm kind of repeating myself here, but it's important to say, you know, this was an opportunity more than anything to remember that all kinds of emergencies happen. He urged people to prepare by building a survival kit, making a plan, being informed, because, you know, we've just come through our kind of winter storm season. We're in theory preparing for our hurricane season. We thought we'd never see tornadoes on the Cape, and yet we're seeing kind of all these things. So he said all hazards planning is really a year-round thing.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, it is only April, but the summer season is on its way, and so is the opening of the new Sandwich Boardwalk. The town is replacing the boardwalk following repeated storm damage. It's a popular spot for locals and visitors alike, so lots of people are looking forward to the opening. CAI's Jeanette Barnes visited the boardwalk this week to see how the work is going, and she's joining us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
If you would, give us a visual sense of what the boardwalk is like right now. What does it look like so far, all this construction? How far has it gotten?
Yes, well, it is actually getting close to finish, so it does look similar to the old boardwalk, only with the railings that were in the plan. And they have installed all of the pilings for the whole span, starting from Town Neck Beach across the marsh inland to the parking area at Boardwalk Road. The deck boards there are a dark hardwood called Ipe from Brazil. And when I was there this week, that those decking boards had been installed from Town Neck Beach almost to the bridge at Mill Creek. So not all the boards were screwed down yet, though, and the railings are in up to about the same point, right? So most of the remaining work is going to be on the bridge and then toward the landward side. The railings are made of pressure-treated wood, and they are going to have one of those, again, dark brown Ipe boards as a top handrail. And what else? Oh, filling in below the handrails in those railings, there is the stainless steel mesh. That was something that was discussed a lot in town. It's a very open mesh. To me, the word mesh almost doesn't really even give you the picture. These are like stainless wires that are fairly narrow, and the openings are wide. They're 6 inches across, and that people wanted a way to minimize the blocking of sight lines going across the marsh. So when you look through the boardwalk, you can look through it, not just at it. That's pretty much where it stands now.
They have pilings there that are supporting the whole thing. They had to drive new pilings, or they're using some older pilings?
Yes, well, my understanding is most of them are new steel pilings, 35 feet into the ground, and that doesn't count the part above ground. But the pilings on and the bridge area actually are the wooden pilings that were there before, and they were tested and they were in such good condition they were able to reuse them. They did sort of splice an additional section of piling onto the top of it because it needs to be higher. It's going to be higher than it was before.
You
And then
reported.
all of
Nope.
those,
Go
sorry,
ahead.
go ahead. The steel pilings are covered though in pressure treated wood to maintain the look of a wooden structure. And then there's something you can't really see, but they were working on this the other day as well, is filling in with grout in between the steel piling and that wooden exterior.
You reported that some of the beams were lifted into place by a helicopter. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. So these steel beams were delivered to the Town Neck Beach parking lot, staged there, and then lifted by a helicopter over the marsh and laid in place. And of course, that's because trucks could not and should not be driving over that spongy marsh. But the members of the construction crew carried the rest of the timber that they used out onto that marsh by hand. And when I asked the contractors what were some of their most memorable moments from the project, they talked about sometimes sinking very deep into that mud while they were carrying all that weight out there. And of course, even though Sandwich didn't have much or maybe even no snow this winter, they were working out there all winter through a lot of freezing cold and rain.
We know that this is a little bit higher than the old boardwalk. Just briefly, tell us what the difference is in the design here.
Yes, it is higher both for storms and to accommodate rising sea levels from climate change. The assistant town engineer, Sam Jensen, was there when I visited, and he said that greater deck height for the new boardwalk is already helping because just recently they had high tides and water went up into the parking lot at Boardwalk Road, but they did not reach the new deck of the boardwalk. So he was pleased with that. The boardwalk is also slightly wider. It's 6 feet instead of 5 feet for accessibility reasons. But probably the biggest change is those railings. So before, only the bridge itself had railings. Now the railings go almost the entire boardwalk, largely because the boardwalk is higher, and anything higher than 30 inches absolutely has to have a railing. But Jensen also says, that makes the boardwalk safer for anyone who needs a little extra stability out there.
We're going to have to leave it there, but it is set to open before summer. No date yet, though, right?
Right. No official date, but they're saying it's on track.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Spring town meeting season is underway and Martha's Vineyard is taking care of business. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here to catch us up. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
We can't get into everything here, so we'll just touch on some highlights. Let's go West Tisbury, Oak Bluffs, and Edgartown. In West Tisbury, it became the first island town to have regulations around short-term rentals. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, like anywhere around the Cape and Islands, short-term rentals have been a hot topic. In West Tisbury on Tuesday night, they passed new regulations that were pretty contested. They set kind of a day limit, minimum limits for rental periods. It's now going to be a two-night minimum you have to stay in West Tisbury. They also, an owner can only have one short-term rental property, and they also have to live in that property for 30 days.
In Oak Bluffs, one of the big questions was changes to allow for industrial and business zoning, and voters did not approve these. We had talked about this heading into the election.
Yeah, no, this became a very controversial subject. There were signs kind of all over the place about this. There was a proposal that Oak Bluffs basically only has like a few commercial streets, Circuit Ave being the main one. And there was a look at potentially putting a new overlay district that would allow you to, with planning board permission, open up different types of businesses. This construction, storage, I mean, even mining was a proposal on the table. And this got very controversial. A lot of people were nervous that this could kind of usher in all kinds of stuff into their neighborhoods. And yeah, it was bitterly contested at town meeting, and eventually, overwhelmingly, was failed.
And in Oak Bluffs, one of the big questions was changes. I'm sorry, in Edgartown, there was plenty of discussion, but approving a new budget seemed to figure as the biggest item of business that passed. Is that right?
The budget was a big thing, but one of the bigger things at town meeting was the so-called party bylaw about if you could have
Party
gatherings of
50 or
more than
more,
50
right?
people. Yeah, exactly. So there was a question if you could have more than 50 or more people at multiple events a year. There was a concern that residential homes are now becoming kind of de facto event centers, or kind of venues, gathering venues for folks. And that became really contested, and it eventually kind of that went back and forth and eventually failed at town meeting.
So they voted to let that. There was a moment where they were going to table that, but they decided not to do that. Is that right?
It was postponed indefinitely, yeah.
Okay.
So that was put off indefinitely. It didn't pass, I should have said.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was definitely it was a thing. Who knows? Maybe it'll come back at some other point if they keep workshopping a little bit. But some people, there was definitely a concern about infringement of rights of folks.
I know that you were covering some of the eclipse sort of response on the island, what people were doing. What did you see?
Yeah, there was a lot of gatherings out here on the island to see eclipse. I was over at the Martha's Vineyard Museum. There was probably about 300 people who had gathered to come see it. There was kind of food, family kind of events. There was a wedding over here in Edgartown outside of the town hall to kind of coincide with the eclipse. We also had a baby born during the eclipse. So yeah, it was all kinds of good fun out here.
Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Steve.
People in North Harwich were told not to drink tap water this week after an incident in Dennis sent firefighting foam into the water supply. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with the latest on this story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us what we know right now, and then we can talk about how we got here. What's the situation right now for folks in North Harwich?
Well, the other day, the samples were taken of the water and sent out to test to determine if this foam material was present. Initially, there was a no drink order for the entire town after this contamination was suspected. That was narrowed to North Harwich. And after the test came back clean yesterday, that order was lifted. So as of now, the officials are saying the water in throughout Harwich is safe to drink. They've taken additional samples just to make sure that all traces of any kind of contamination are gone.
Now, this was firefighting foam that was used to extinguish a fire in Dennis on Tuesday. And we've been reporting a lot about firefighting foams and the dangers around them. When they used to contain forever chemicals called PFAS, this
Sure.
firefighting foam did not have that. Is that right?
That's right. The Harwich Fire Department got rid of any foam that contained PFAS quite a while ago. So this was biodegradable foam, and according to the Harwich Fire Department, what happened was that there was at the fire department responded to the fire in Dennis, which is right over the town line on Great Western Road, and hooked up to a nearby fire hydrant in Harwich, which was on the Harwich side of the line. And at the same time, the Dennis department responded and hooked up to their hydrants. And the way I understand it is there was a differential in pressure when they started using foam because of some chemicals that were in this warehouse that was on fire. And those and the foam backed into the Harwich water system. And that's when they discovered that there was some contamination. People started noticing some foaming in their tap water. And that's when the town immediately issued that do not drink order Wednesday.
Mm. Seemed like the town moved really quickly on this to get the word out to people and to try to make sure that people had water themselves.
They did. The notice went out early Wednesday morning, and by Wednesday afternoon, the town had arranged to distribute bottled water at the family pantry facility further into Harwich on Great Western Road. And they also delivered bulk water to some local farms so that they could continue doing what they usually do, keep their livestock watered, et cetera. The officials estimated that once they narrowed the problem to North Harwich, there were about 354 homes directly affected by that order. And many of those people showed up to get bottled water. You know, shortly after the order was issued, the local supermarkets completely sold out of bottled water. So the town really needed to do something, and they did step up and get that relief in there right away.
And then no drinking order has been lifted as of yesterday afternoon.
Yesterday afternoon, right after they got those tests back, the water department put out the word that the water was safe to drink. They did warn residents, especially in the North Harwich area, that there could be some discoloration in their water because it's part of what they needed to do to get this contamination out of the water system. It was to flush hydrants in the area, so they were flushing a lot of water out of the piping in the area, and sometimes that dislodges things that are in the pipes and can cause some discoloration. But they basically recommended that people run their tap for about 10 minutes, and that should take care of any problems.
Hey, Tim, I've been asking folks what they did for the eclipse. What did you do? Did you go out and look at it?
Well, I went out and looked at it. I was actually at my office here in Chatham, and we had some glasses. And those of us who were there, we watched it. We had a reporter in Harwich, where the Brooks Library sponsored a viewing party. There were about 300 people at Brooks Park, where there were everything from pie plates affixed with viewing glasses that people could pass around. They even had eclipse cupcakes that people could partake in. It was a pretty festive occasion, and we've got coverage of that in this week's paper.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
A recent ruling by a judge on the legality of short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods on Nantucket appears to have big implications for towns around the region, including on the Outer Cape. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us to talk about this. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
Let's start by explaining what the judge ruled here, essentially that short-term rentals are not a right specifically spelled out in residential zoning. And I guess it depends how they're being operated, if they're being operated as a business or a principal use. Is that right?
Yes. Without going really into the details of the ruling, the question is, are short-term rentals their own kind of use that needs to be regulated in zoning tables, or is it just part of normal residential use? And Nantucket had ordered that short-term rentals are part of normal residential use. They don't need to be put in the zoning code. And the court found that that's not okay. And additionally, that the way the zoning code was written in Nantucket and in most of Cape Cod towns, where you have to list out your specific allowed uses, if you don't write short-term rental as an allowed principal use, it can't be. And it takes a two-thirds vote of town meeting to add to the zoning bylaw to make it an acceptable principal use.
I guess that raises so many questions for so many parts of our region where short-term rentals have already become such a big part of the economy. Are towns scrambling now to try to figure out how to address this?
It is a pretty big ruling. I should add that accessory use, the court said, would be allowed. So if you are using your property residentially yourself, even if it's a second home, and then this is accessory to your use of the home, then there's ways to allow that without necessarily updating your zoning code. But a house that is not really used as a second home, that is maybe corporate-owned or investor-owned, or even if one person has three of them, they can't necessarily claim that they live in all three if they're all in the same town. So you start to run into some part of the industry that has been building out in recent years that now either has to find its way into the zoning code with a two-thirds vote, or maybe is on the wrong side of new lines that get drawn.
On the Outer Cape, Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, how are they looking at this, and what have you heard from town officials about how they're trying to interpret this?
Everyone's definitely paying attention to it. I didn't find a lot of people eager to comment because it is both a fast-moving thing, you know, the ruling just came out, and also it's a huge economic sector. I mean, there's about $100 million a year in short-term rental bookings that are taxed just in the four Outer Cape towns. The number for all of Cape Cod is about $400 million a year. Mm. That's the 2023 figures based on the state tax. So it's a huge part of the economy, obviously, and trying to figure out where to draw the line between accessory use that is allowed and principal use, which is either not allowed or you have to vote for it by two-thirds. You know, it's a big puzzle with a couple moving parts, one of which is the voters.
And we do know that a number of towns have been already struggling to come up with rules around short-term rentals, including Nantucket, who's been talking about this for years, it feels like, and have not been able to land on anything that enough people can agree on.
Yes, Nantucket is heading into their, fifth town meeting on the subject. They had pretty significant town meetings in 21, 22, and then two in last year in 2023. However, West Tisbury did just pass on Tuesday a pretty comprehensive short-term rental. Now, granted, it's a general bylaw, but they passed it by well more than two-thirds. It was like a 90% vote. So they could add that as a zoning bylaw as well, and they apparently have the votes in West Tisbury for something.
Who gets to say whether something's an accessory use or a principal use?
In the individual case, the judge sent it back to the ZBA to decide.
The Zoning Board of Appeals.
Yes, and they have to use certain standards that are in law about what is a... it has to be customarily incidental, and it also has to be subordinate to the principal use. So they can't just totally make it up. They have to use... There's a whole lot of case law around what subordinate to principal use really means. That said, the ZBA is probably not going to want to keep on deciding on a bunch of individual cases. They're going to want town meeting to make a decision and pass a bylaw that says this is accessory, this is principal. Accessory is fine. This is what we're cool with. Principal use, either we're not going to allow it or we will vote to allow it.
We're already spring town meeting season, so things aren't going to move that quickly. But do you think towns are looking at fall and trying to figure out how to set up some kind of structure here so that there's some allowance formally in town bylaws for short-term rentals?
I think fall is when you'll see this, yes. Nantucket debated whether to try to get a new proposal into their warrant for May 7th. I don't believe they are moving forward with that, but a fall town meeting, I think in a lot of towns, is going to be on the agenda as a time to try to update the zoning code and figure out how short-term rental is going to fit in to these allowable uses in all the different zones. You know, this isn't just a two-choice, you know, binary decision. Mm-hmm. Towns have multiple zones in which they have to decide what will be allowed and what won't.
It's going to make for interesting conversations heading into the fall, I can imagine.
I think it'll keep the town halls pretty busy.
It's Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent, where you can read all about it. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
A Nantucket seasonal resident walking off the trails looking for deer antlers found a set of human bones instead. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has more details on this and joins us. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Jason, this is kind of a startling story, but there aren't a lot of details here. It appears that the bones were likely there for some while. Tell us about what we know.
Yeah, so this all occurred last Friday, actually Thursday evening is when these bones were discovered by a seasonal resident who was, as you said, walking in the woods, a very dense, swampy area in between Tom Nevers and Sconset on the east end of the island. And this gentleman, Peter McHugh, who's a Connecticut resident who's been coming to Nantucket for 20 years, owns a home out here, was looking for deer antler sheds. A lot of people do that out here, pretty common. And this was an area, he said, that, you know, was pretty remote and dense and swampy, but did have a lot of deer stands. So people had been hunting in there. People had been walking through there. And it caught his eye sort of from 10 feet away, what he thought was initially was a deer skeleton, a dead deer. As he got closer, realized and was sort of in disbelief, you know, am I looking at a human skull there? And turns out that's exactly what it was. He called his friend who told him, you know, you got to call the police. And they immediately responded that evening, and as did the state police, and removed these remains from the area. And the case has now been taken over by the state medical examiner. And there is hope that with the state of the remains, as you know, as you said, they had been there for a while, but the bones were relatively intact, and there is hope that they are going to be able to identify them.
Hmm. Also this week, the health department on the island ruled that no food trucks could operate at Cisco Beach this summer. They're enforcing a rule that's actually been on the books for a long time.
Yeah, so this is a something that people are pretty upset about this week, to hear that we're not going to have the food trucks at Cisco Beach, which is one of the most popular beaches and surfing spots on the South Shore. The health department said that to operate there, these food trucks were going to need formal bathroom facilities with hot water to be able to wash their hands, have their staff wash their hands, and outside of the food preparation area inside the truck. Now, this is an area that's owned by the Nantucket Land Bank, and they license anywhere from 2 to 3 food trucks to operate there during the summer. There had been some discussion about setting up a portable, you know, sort of trailer style bathroom, but this is also an area that does not have electricity, doesn't have plumbing. So they were going to have to, you know, set up a generator, and it was a more sort of complicated than they initially anticipated, and have opted not to do that. So the variance request that they had sought from the Board of Health was denied. And so it looks like we're not going to have that out there this summer, and it's going to be sort of bring BYOB or bring your own. We're going to see if the health department and the land bank and some of the vendors can work something out in the meantime. But for now, that is the decision.
BYOL, bring your own lunch. Yes.
Yes, exactly.
I've been asking folks about the eclipse and how it was where they were. What was it like on Nantucket?
Yeah, we had great weather, and the Mariah Mitchell Association, along with the Nantucket Community School and the public schools, held actually a huge gathering after school. All students were, upon dismissal, were given the safe eclipse viewing glasses. And everyone gathered at the old baseball field next to the high school. About 1,500 people showed up and kind of took it all in together, had the educators from Mariah Mitchell sort of talking to folks and sharing their telescopes. And it was a really nice community event for people to get together and sort of take in this once-in-a-generation event, even though, you know, we weren't in totality. It was still pretty cool to see, and it was great to see everyone get together.
1,500 people, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a great turnout, and they did it really well with providing glasses for everyone and a space for people to get together and learn and talk to some of the educators at Mariah Mitchell, and so it was a really nice turnout.
Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll check in with the latest news from the State House. And we'll hear about why Cuttyhunk Island is concerned about its harbor. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. This week at the State House in Boston, House lawmakers put out their version of next year's budget, which is close to $60 billion. And state police are working on how to improve how they interact with drivers during traffic stops. Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke to our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about these stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Hello, Katie.
Hey, good morning.
Katie, we've experienced an earthquake and an eclipse since we last spoke a week ago. And yet, amid all this, the Massachusetts House put out its $58 billion budget proposal. Lawmakers say it's looking like zero growth from tax revenue next year. Yet, they are putting a lot of money toward the emergency shelter system. Katie, this is a rewrite, if you will, of the budget that Governor Healey filed earlier this year. How does this version differ?
Well, the big difference is that it's a little bit smaller, reflecting that challenging financial circumstance the state finds itself in. The House is proposing to spend about $150 million less than the governor, which sounds like a ton of money until you take into account that it is over $58 billion as the total bottom line there. And to do that, they are proposing to spend a little bit less than the governor in some areas like snow and ice removal. And they're also, though, omitting a money-saving measure she made, which was the governor proposed cutting, making some eligibility restrictions on MassHealth's personal care attendant program, which helps people with disabilities perform daily tasks so they can live at home. And that's the House credited the pushback they've really heard from advocates, from people with disabilities, from healthcare workers there. In saying they want to maintain those services. The House budget also takes a little bit of a different approach than the governor in spending that millionaire's tax money on education and transportation. They're trying to split that a little bit closer to 50-50 than she did, but not getting quite all the way there. So we're going to see how that proposal changes as the House debates it later this month.
Okay. Well, for the last year or so, State Auditor Diana DeZoglio has been pushing for this full accounting of the lawmakers' books. She's gone head-to-head with these lawmakers over this. It's the last thing they want to do. But it seems now, Katie, voters might be on her side.
Yeah, a poll conducted recently by the Mass Inc. polling group for GBH News, Commonwealth Beacon, found that about 53% of Mass residents like this idea of auditing the legislature would vote yes on a ballot question. But another key piece there is that 35% are undecided. So as we inch closer to Election Day and we hear more of that pro-transparency messaging from DeZoglio and more pushback from lawmakers and other critics who say, hey, wait a second, there's constitutional implications here if you give another elected official this kind of power over the legislature. We're really going to be watching to see how that big chunk of undecided voters and residents as a whole moves on this issue.
It's also been several months, Katie, since the state treasurer suspended the head cannabis regulator. A two-day hearing was supposed to happen between the parties, but it's now been kicked down the road. Can you remind us who Shannon O'Brien is and what's been happening in the interim?
Yeah, former state treasurer herself, Shannon O'Brien, had been named by Goldberg as the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission. O'Brien says she was brought in as a change agent, but she was put last fall on a paid suspension, and we didn't know why for a while. It later came out that an outside report had said she'd made a series of racist, culturally insensitive marks, which O'Brien herself has denied. But, you know, Goldberg and O'Brien were in court over this matter. It's been a long-running issue to decide her fate. And with that hearing postponed due to unforeseen circumstances, not a lot of clear detail why, we ultimately don't know how this will resolve, if O'Brien will ultimately be fired or if she'll be able to return to the CCC, which has been under the leadership of an acting chair while they continue their work in this fledgling industry.
Yeah, that's the Cannabis Control Commission. Okay, Katie. Finally, state police are working to improve how they interact with drivers who are on the autism spectrum. Tell us a bit about the need for this and exactly how this communication will be improved.
Yeah, in connection with some autism advocacy day at the State House, there was an announcement this week from the state police that they will be allowing drivers the opportunity to choose to place copies of their license, registration, and the insurance info inside a blue envelope, which has instructions for both the driver and a police officer who might conduct a traffic stop. If the driver is on the autism spectrum, telling not only the driver what to expect in this situation, But letting the officers know that this driver might be exhibiting signs of anxiety from the lights or the noises involved in this, they may be displaying repetitive body movements, it's designed to take the temperature down and what can be fraught interactions and prevent police from misinterpreting the behavior of a driver on the autism spectrum. The state Senate has also taken steps to roll out a program like this, but with that bill still tied up in the House, the state police seem to like the idea and are acting on their own here.
That's an intriguing development. Katie Lannon from the State House, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Cuddy Hunk is a small island at the bottom of the Elizabeth Island chain at the foot of Buzzards Bay. A small private ferry runs to it from New Bedford, but that service could be in jeopardy. Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light has this story and joins us. Hi, Adam.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
The navigational channel into Cuddy Hunk's harbor is in danger of filling in, which would cut off access to the island. Can you start just by describing this channel? It's important to be able to picture this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. And it's funny, you know, it's days like this where we're getting a southerly storm going up south that are affecting the channel in Cuddy Hunk. So it's a 10-foot deep navigational channel dredged by Congress in the early 20th century. And essentially, its service is to, you know, open and allow boat traffic into the channel. And in recent years, there have been efforts to stabilize it after a number of hurricanes hit in the earlier 20th century and as well as in the later 20th century. But long story short, in the mid-century, they sunk a series of wooden car barges off the southeastern end of Canapitsit Neck, which is the southern end of Cuddy Hunk's channel, the southern barrier protecting it. And so they sunk roughly 14 barges to stabilize it, and they built a dike in the 1960s to further stabilize the channel, but those barges are starting to erode, and that's causing increased erosion to this channel. So, to get started, I mean, it's critical to the island. It allows provides for really access to the mainland for both year-round residents of the island of roughly there are 10 plus, and as well as visitors, which drive significant revenue to the Cuddy Hunk economy. So it's really critical to the function and to the economy of the town that this channel remains open.
So a series of storms have started to fill in this channel again, but your story is really drawing a line to the bigger impacts of climate change here, not just a single weather event, it seems like.
Certainly, Steve. Yeah, I mean, these southerly storms, as we're seeing today, are becoming an increasingly common occurrence as the effects of climate change really take hold in the Northeast. We're expected to see stronger storms, higher seas, and stronger winds, and longer lasting storms as well, which is going to drive an increasing amount of storm surge waves and erosions on Cuddy Hunk's barrier beaches and islands. So it's really, this issue is a growing problem, and one that residents and leaders on the island are seeing intensifying coming years. And in the past, they've generally just stuck to maintenance dredging or calling the Corps out for emergency dredging. But it seems that the problem is growing so frequent that the Corps' dredges can't keep up with the matter at hand. So they're really seeking a longer-term solution that secure their future amid these mounting climate impacts.
Well, describe that a little bit more for us. What does a long-term solution for this look like?
Certainly, Steve, and there's a lot of, this is where things get tricky, right? There's a lot of debate over what this solution may look like. Cuddy Hunk, aside from being a long-term summer enclave and a driver of the economy of Buzzards Bay, is also home to a number of endangered seabirds, including least terns and piping plovers, which are on the Massachusetts endangered species list, and as well as the plovers, anyway, are also on the federal endangered species list and are protected from human disturbance on the island. So finding a solution that protects the channel, allows for continued access to the beach, and also protects these birds is complicated, as you may imagine. So the Army Corps and the islanders believe the solution will be extending a 1,300-foot stone dike that was put in place in the 60s that's really helped stabilize that eastern edge of Canapitsit Neck. And in extending it the whole way down onto the beach, onto Barges Beach, which is west of the dike on the neck, and essentially using that to stabilize the dike long term. But state agencies have noted this may have a severe impact on, you know, these populations of endangered birds on the island. And Buzzards Bay Coalition is still waiting on further study to really make a decision on what they would like to see in terms of this. There are other options, including a sand cobble berm and, you know, a dune restoration plan. But those run into economic challenges and may exacerbate the issue of the channel filling with sand on the island, which is really threatening to cut it off. So this is an issue of debate. The Army Corps is going out this spring to do a drone survey that's going to help inform some of these options. But as of now, the solution seems tricky.
And as you point out, there's 10 year-round residents on this island, and then it swells in summer. About how many people are coming in summer to the island?
In summer to the island, it's roughly under 1,000 people, a few hundred people. Some people stay on their boats. Others have seasonal residences on the island, second homes, and yeah, certainly. But it's interesting that, you know, the number of migratory birds on the island seem to outnumber the year-round residents. So it's a point of contention for sure, and they're looking for a way to coexist.
Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light, where there's also a series of great photographs along with this story. Adam, thank you so much.
Certainly, Steve. Always a pleasure.
We're going to return one last time to the eclipse. An estimated 220,000 people headed to New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont to see the total solar eclipse on Monday. Here on the Cape, we got about 90% totality. One of the people who headed up for the total eclipse was CAI producer Elsa Partan, who joins us now. Hi, Elsa.
Hi, Steve.
First off, with 220,000 extra people on the roads, how was the traffic getting up there?
We didn't hit any significant traffic in either direction, but we did drive on Saturday to get up and then Tuesday to get back. I heard from one friend from Central Mass that it took her 12 hours to get home from Vermont immediately after the eclipse. So I think it really depended on when you decided to drive.
Okay, so where did you go, and what was your impression of the total solar eclipse?
I watched the eclipse with about a dozen HUI engineers and their families in a barnyard in West Glover, Vermont, which is about 30 minutes from the Canadian border. Now, I had seen the partial solar eclipse in 2017 here on Cape Cod. I was right out in back of CAI, I remember. And it was neat to see the little shadows on the ground with the slice taken out of the sun. And it was a festive atmosphere then, and I'm sure it was this time. But I can say I understand now why people say that's nothing like a total solar eclipse.
I have not seen a total solar eclipse. Again, last Monday, I was out there watching the 90% eclipse. I'm so curious. What was it like? Can you just describe it for us, the total eclipse?
So for the eclipse on Monday, the world was still relatively bright right up until the moment of totality. And then when the moon slid over the sun completely, there was instantly like 360 degrees of twilight. It was like almost like a sunset, but all the way around. Everyone gasped. It was shocking. And then you see a fiery ring circling the moon, and you could almost imagine a sound from the eclipse. It would have been like the whoosh of a blowtorch. Tears started running down my face. I barely even noticed. Venus and Jupiter were immediately visible. Stars came out. The temperature dropped. The breeze, there was a little 5-mile-an-hour breeze, just halted. And then I heard a duck say, quack. It lasted about 3 minutes. And the first moment that a sliver of the sun was visible, the world came bursting into color, and I heard someone in our crowd yell, "She's back!" Then it was over, and everyone just sort of returned to like normal life. But for 3 minutes, the world was upside down.
And what you told me was when the first instant of the sun reappeared again for real,
yeah,
it turned back into day.
Yeah. Just instantly day. I mean, the light was a little weird, of course, but like it was the difference between, it's just the strangest thing.
It's CAI's Elsa Partan. Elsa, thank you for bringing us that.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes, Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Grazia of Nantucket Current, Patrick Flannery speaking with Katie Lannon at the State House and Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light, CAI's Elsa Partan there. I'm Steve Junker. Thanks for listening.